Welcome to The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. This edition of The Week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels. This week, two stories from The Scientist Daily News. One on how vaccine researchers and manufacturers are looking beyond eggs for an avian flu vaccine, for obvious reasons, and another on whether human embryonic stem cells research may be in jeopardy in the EU, even in member states where the research is legal. Then columnist Glenn McGee wonders whether the outsourcing of clinical trials to India represents a new imperialism. First, Ishani Ganguly reports that timeliness and the risks to eggs in the event of an avian flu pandemic has led companies to seek other production methods.
The global spread of avian flu is putting more pressure on vaccine developers to rethink their traditional techniques, which rely heavily on eggs to incubate vaccine stocks. The lethality of avian flu in poultry makes it unlikely that there will be 4 billion embryonated eggs available, which is the number needed to protect the 1.2 billion people at high risk in the case of a pandemic, according to Surya Prakash Sambara at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Cell culture is emerging as a viable and versatile alternative to eggs for churning out large quantities of vaccine. Last November, President Bush asked Congress for $2.8 billion to develop such technologies, which have been used for decades to manufacture vaccines for well-defined diseases like measles. And while the transition from eggs to culture for flu vaccine represents a, quote, considerable investment, unquote, vaccine industry leaders like Chiron, GlaxoSmithKline, and Sanofi are now jumping on board, said Richard Webby, a vaccine researcher at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. Solvay Pharmaceuticals has already been licensed in Europe to use Madden-Darby canine kidney cells lines for commercial production of human vaccines, and has just built a BSL-3 production site in the Netherlands, while Protein Sciences Corporation has developed its seasonal vaccine flu block to grow in insect cells. Others are working with cell lines from African green monkeys, Vero, or humans, per C6. The other advantage of cell culture methods is speed. Because egg production methods take up to 9 months, manufacturers must rely on distant predictions of how the virus will mutate as it traverses the world. Using cell culture methods, Solvay Global Senior Vice President Harald Schleven predicted it would take 2.5 months to produce upwards of 180 million to 200 million doses of antigen in case of a pandemic. The whole scalability of the cell-based vaccine production facility is a big advantage, he said. Rather than directly inoculating live virus into cells, a technique used by Solvay and others, which many say poses a risk of infecting workers, companies like Lentigen Corporation are looking to viral vector delivery systems to speed up the process. Lentigen is now validating the use of lentiviral vectors to deliver carefully chosen, quote, genes of an avian or seasonal flu virus into mammalian cells for highly efficient production of a vaccine, said CEO Baro Dropulich. The replication-incompetent vaccine product would be ready within 4 months of a pandemic strain's emergence, Dropulich predicted. Protein Sciences uses baculovirus vectors to a similar end, while the CDC's Sambara has developed adenoviral vectors to deliver the gene to human cells. And he says his collaborators at Purdue University are now negotiating with industry to manufacture the vaccine in cell cultures. Protein Sciences COO, Manon Cox, said her company is working on using recombinant virus libraries to create trivalent vaccine primers based on likely pandemic-causing strains that could provide people with low-level protection before a pandemic even arose. And once a pandemic strain is identified, they could match it to the correct vector in the library to produce the vaccine in weeks, she said. You want to have virus banks already ready in your freezer so you can pull it out and be ready, she said. Reverse genetics, in which researchers directly combine antigen genes from the target virus with genes from a master strain, known to grow readily in eggs, has become a popular method of custom designing seed strains. Classical reassortment strategies, in contrast, require scientists to mix target and master strains in hundreds of chicken eggs and screen for the most immunogenic and easily grown reassortment product. The strategy has led to a number of clinical trials worldwide, according to Webby, whose team designed the seed strain for Sanofi Pasteur that recently produced disappointing results in phase 3 trials. For the highly pathogenic H5N1 strain, which would likely kill chicken cells before they could produce vaccine, such genetic manipulation is the only viable method, said Webby. Regulatory issues remain a concern for some manufacturers. For example, in Europe and Australia, the status of the manipulated virus as genetically modified organisms gives manufacturers another round of paperwork. But earlier this month, the FDA issued draft guidelines to help vaccine makers expedite development for both pandemic and seasonal flu vaccines. The guidelines demonstrate how to adapt existing licenses to those for pandemic flu vaccines and navigate the accelerated approval process, which relies on biological indicators of immunogenicity rather than placebo-controlled trials. GlaxoSmithKline's Fluarix was the first vaccine approved last year using the accelerated process, which Cox calls, quote, very good for the FDA because they are able to take larger risks than they otherwise would, end quote. It's absolutely essential for the government to partner with companies as well as university scientists, the way we have done over now several years, said Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. We are simultaneously trying to optimize existing vaccines and develop new vaccine platforms that will make vaccine production more flexible and more specific. Fauci said the government may provide liability protection to companies developing pandemic flu vaccines. For example, the Biodefense and Pandemic Vaccine and Drug Development Act, which has yet to be voted on by the U.S. Senate, would offer liability protection for vaccine manufacturers and a 10-year marketing exclusivity for companies producing countermeasures, during which time competitors could not produce generic substitutes.
Next, Ned Stafford reports that the funding of human embryonic stem cell research may be in jeopardy. Germany, Austria, and other nations opposed to EU funding of human embryonic stem cell research proposed an EU funding ban last month in Brussels at a meeting of the EU's 25 national science ministers, raising concerns that the minority group could force nations to remove this funding from the newest budget, even for scientists in countries where the research is legal. The six nations, including also Italy, Poland, Malta, and Slovakia, failed to win additional backing at the meeting for a funding ban, but do hold enough combined voting power in the Council of Science Ministers to form a so-called blocking minority. This means they could halt enactment of the EU's next science funding program for 2007 through 2013, known as Framework Program 7, FP7, unless wording is added to the final FP7 document that would ban EU funding of human embryonic stem cell research. Under Framework Program 6, FP6, guidelines, the EU gives funding priority to human adult stem cell research and will not fund any research on embryonic stem cells conducted in member states that forbid the research. Under FP6, 8 projects involving human embryonic stem cell research have been funded and nearly 100 involving human adult stem cells have received funding approval, said Antonio Moshan, spokeswoman for EU Research Commissioner Janez Potocnik. Moshan told the scientist that Potocnik has recommended that current guidelines pertaining to funding of human embryonic stem cell research in FP6 be retained in FP7. Although the six nations oppose this proposal, 15 nations agree and 4 are neutral. Before any FP7 money for research can start flowing, a final plan must be approved by a qualified majority of the Council's 25 science ministers and also by the European Parliament. Daniel Pipelers, professor at Brussels Free University, VUB, and director of JDRF Center for Beta Cell Therapy in Diabetes, which will receive about 1 million euros from the EU in direct support of human embryonic stem cell research from 2005 through 2010 under FP6 guidelines, told the scientist that he is concerned. According to Moshan, already approved FP6 money would not be affected by changes in FP7. Pipelers added that a small group of nations should not impose a minority opinion on the EU. I don't think they can decide for the whole EU, he said, adding that successful research in human embryonic stem cells requires collaboration among scientists across the EU, involving also teams working on adult stem cells, as well as ethicists. Trying to block EU incentives and support for such European scientific collaboration goes too far. This is a familiar situation to EU scientists. Opponents of human embryonic stem cell research actively sought an EU funding ban in FP6, Pipler said, but eventually accepted the current guidelines. They may not give up as easily this time, he added. In an interview with The Scientist, Florian Frank, a spokesman for Germany's new Minister of Education and Research, Annette Schavan, who strongly opposes human embryonic stem cell research, said that Germany's position is that EU funding should not be used for research purposes that are not legal in Germany, even if those projects take place in other countries. If EU money is being used to support research not legal in Germany, then we have something to say about that, he said. Frank added that Germany would continue trying to convince other nations to accept this position. This is politics. You try to convince the others. However, he declined to say if Germany would form a blocking minority if the FP7 does not ban EU funding for human embryonic stem cell research. Finally, The Scientist's ethics columnist, Glenn McGee, in his April column, asks what Gandhi would have thought of the outsourcing of clinical trials to India.
Salt in the wound. Will India rise up against the oppression of foreign clinical trials? In March of 1930, Mohandas Gandhi set out from his ashram in western India on a 387-kilometer trek to the sea. 25 days later, the tens of thousands who joined that march watched as he stooped, raised a handful of salty mud, and, well, declared the end of British imperialism in India. The march ended as Gandhi led the nonviolent protesters to the doors of a salt factory in Dharasana, where they attempted to push their way into the facility without any kind of weapons or raising their fists at all. It didn't work. On that hot day, hundreds were beaten in a spectacle that would make its way into newspapers worldwide and ultimately change the face of India. If Gandhi were alive today, he would probably lead protesters to the doors of another battle that he probably also wouldn't win, but this time the doors would be of a clinical research trials facility, where the oppression of the Indian poor really does dwarf that of the 1930s. Why? Well, not because Gandhi was a Luddite, a man who held meetings while spinning thread, and not because many of the excellent research institutions that have led India into its embrace of multinational bioengineering and medical research all bear his family name. No, the problem for Gandhi would be the outsourced clinical trials that have enrolled tens of thousands of Indians in a billion-dollar business that's not aimed at the improvement of Indians' health or Indian science and technology, but at providing deep discounts to pharmaceutical companies in other countries. It's a kind of perfect storm. The number of open slots in clinical trials around the world has increased. The number of Americans, for example, willing to enroll in those trials lags. As few as 1.7% of patients with cancer now enroll in a clinical trial. And the cost of clinical trials in India is half that of the United States. So it's no surprise that American and European pharmaceutical companies are fanning out across the second most populous nation ever in the world. Physicians in India report that largely illiterate subject populations, who are entirely unclear about risks and benefits, really only ask them one question: doctor, should I enroll? At least one study in the Indian Journal of Medical Ethics reported that many Indian research subjects are just plain utterly unprepared to distinguish between any kind of trial, particularly between trials likely to provide a benefit and those that will not. For a little more on that, see www.issuesinmedicalethics.org. According to a 2005 report in New England Journal of Medicine, fewer than 200 of the 14,000 general hospitals in India are even capable of conducting clinical trials in an adequate way. So why? Why do Indians, most of whom are poor, flock to clinical trials? Well, it's the poor thing. One reason is that most of the hospital is served by small and ill-equipped hospitals, and the chambers of commerce for clinical trials in India point to the advantages of that fact. Indian patients are untreated, reducing the number of confounding factors in study of medications, and a tiny payment by U.S. standards to an Indian enrollee in a clinical trial could amount to 3 months' wages or more. Incentive payments to physicians for enrolling research subjects are also amplified, and amplified a lot by the exchange rate. The government attempted in 2004 to rein in unsafe international clinical trials by insisting that drugs that were tested in India have to first be proven safe in their country of origin. But that law was eliminated in 2005, followed closely by an avalanche of new trials. Concerns about trials that are designed to demonstrate nominally important data, or trials that are poorly designed or just plain unsafe, well, those concerns abound. Some trials are conducted in humans without any prior animal studies having been performed. In one unapproved clinical trial, for example, 435 women were given an anti-cancer drug to treat fertility, but not told that the drug wasn't cleared for that use at all. The same imperialism that supported the salt factories of Dharasana in the 1930s, the same thing today manifests itself in Mumbai or Sevagram, all around India, where clinical trials far too offensive for American research subjects are offered to a billion residents of the nation that Gandhi fought so hard to emancipate in the first place. The only question that really remains is how long it'll be before the people of the nation of Gandhi rise up to reject the new imperialism.
Join us online at www.the-scientist.com for more of the Scientist Daily News, including the winners of the Life Science Industry Awards, blogs on current events, controversies and conferences, and features from our April print edition. This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.